This episode is brought to you by Thorn, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorn is now offering you an ongoing 35% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorn is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorn.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorn. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorn, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show Merchant Marine, Navy SEAL veteran, and the Chief Executive Officer of Guardian Revival, Alex Othmer. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from Alex's early life, his unique journey into the SEAL teams, the healing power of plant medicine, canine therapy, music, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single five-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of almost 1,000 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Alex Othmer. Enjoy. Well, Alex, I want to start by saying two things. Firstly, thank you to Joe McCulloch from O2X for connecting us initially. And secondly, to welcome you onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thanks, James. I really appreciate you having me on.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you this afternoon?
That's a great way to ask that question. I'm in New York. I live about an hour north of New York City, and hometown I grew up in, and built a house next to my parents. So my backyard.
Fantastic. Well, that perfect segue to the next question then. So let's start at the very beginning of that timeline. So tell me exactly where you grew up and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings.
So I grew up in a small town, again, about an hour north of New York City, and kind of in a rural woodsy environment. Grew up playing in the woods, shooting guns, really just like a country boy upbringing. My father was a New York City firefighter, and my whole family was military first responders. So I really grew up into my time in service naturally. My childhood was, you know, we were middle class and pretty easygoing. I had a hard father, but the good type of hard that put me to challenge, and no major trauma or, to least to my knowledge, that I had growing up. Just a fairly normal childhood. Was an athlete, played sports my whole life, and was a wild man.
How long was your father a firefighter for?
So he was a firefighter for like 23 years. And he was also a Marine and was also in the Navy too. So he was a veteran and then transitioned to the New York City Fire Department after that.
With this mature mental health lens that you have post-service as well, when you look back, were there any elements of his service that you realize now were causing some issues?
Absolutely. So he was a firefighter during 9/11, which had an obvious impact on him and my whole family and our community. He just by crazy stand, he got injured about 2 weeks before 9/11 happened and the towers went down. He was on a boat on the Hudson River and he was trying to fix a boat engine and his leg got caught in the motor and ripped his whole knee up. And he actually got life flighted off the boat to West Point for emergency service or emergency surgery. So when 9/11 happened, he was in crutches and he couldn't go down. He couldn't do anything. So he was just had this tremendous survivor's guilt. And the only thing he could do was volunteer to run all the funerals for all the firefighters and their families that were lost that day. So it probably hit him harder than it might have if he was down there that day or was actually able to get his hands dirty. So it's a really interesting dynamic. And that really affected me and my family unit all through growing up, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But he was an alcoholic and suffered from severe PTSD, and he didn't really know what it was at that time.
This is the problem, I think. You know, if you were at the towers, you know, it'd be like, okay, well, you're struggling because you were there. You were on ground zero. You were digging with your hands, whatever it was. But that's 1% of all first responders. You know, 1% of all military were in some, you know, Mogadishu fight for your life, you know, combat, and everyone else was doing the daily grind. And I think this is the problem, is the death by a thousand cuts conversation that we don't really have. And just because your dad wasn't physically at the towers doesn't mean that the cumulative effect of his military service and then in the firefighter's uniform didn't compound. And then obviously at the end, that inability to say that survivor's guilt just kind of crushing load on top of everything.
I mean, you sound like a professional because you are, James, but that's exactly it. It can often, like, one way I look at it is it's a bit of a mirage, because for two things: one, you might have survivor's guilt, and the second is you feel like you're not good enough or you didn't do your part, so you might live the rest of your life trying to prove yourself or accommodate for those perceived shortcomings. And I could see that throughout his life and how he struggled with that.
That imposter syndrome is crazy. And I was just telling my son this the other day, one of my Delta friends said that he's never seen such imposter syndrome as inside the Delta team room, some of the most elite warfighters on the planet. So we all of us suffer from it. And we wear this mask that we're okay. And we look across and everyone else has got their mask on. We're like, well, they're all fine. What's wrong with me behind this mask? And the reality is we all struggle with it.
We all do. It's all imprinted in somewhere in our brain, whether we recognize it or not.
So going back to your childhood, what about athletics and sports? What were you playing and doing?
Yeah, so I played almost every sport under the sun, but I rounded out with football and wrestling, and I boxed in high school as well. And then I carried those with me. I ran track as well, and when I went to the Merchant Marine Academy, which is a federal service academy out in Long Island. And I played football there for 4 years and I ran track. So I carried football with me, but I really enjoyed wrestling the most. Wrestling is like one of the most gut-wrenching sports you could participate in. I don't know if you roll BJJ or if you do some type of combative sport, but those have always been the hardest for me, because it's just you out there on the mat by yourself. So that shaped most of my childhood: intense sports, hot summer double sessions and triple session practices, which kind of shaped my work ethic and my mindset moving on later into life.
I've had this conversation a lot with people that did team sports and individual sports. And obviously the team element, you know, that carries over to the fire service or the Navy SEALs, but there's nothing more humbling than being on the mat on your own. I do jujitsu now, but my first one was taekwondo that I did a lot. And there's no excuses. Like, you know, if you leave it to the hands of the judges, then you haven't done well enough. You know what I mean? Your only real way of winning is to win convincingly. And so I found it such an interesting dynamic, because there's no better way to forge ownership than to put yourself in a sport where it's just you and someone else. So you can't blame anyone except yourself.
Yeah, it's, yes. And I remember some of the most nerve-wracking times of my life growing up, being waiting to start the match, you know, whether it's a boxing match or a wrestling match, and just seeing my opponent on the other side. And that's like psychological warfare right there. And having that exposure as a young kid, like as a teenager, as I slowly becoming a man, I think is so important. It prepares you for life in so many ways, especially as a man. Like, women and men, you know, are just so fundamentally different, I believe. And I think that, I think especially for young men, if they don't get that type of exposure, then I see them having struggles throughout the rest of their life, trying to find that or get that fulfillment of being exposed to that level of psychological pressure and stress. And I'm just grateful that I had that opportunity, and things like wrestling and other combative sports give you that taste.
I grew up on a farm as well. My dad was a vet, a horse vet and a small animal vet. So I grew up, you know, taking care of lambs at 3 a.m. and then getting chastised at school at 9 a.m. They assumed I was watching television. But it was that amazing element of suffering. And this was in England, so it was cold and wet and gloomy as well. And then you look at, myself included, how we all collectively live in 2024. And so many of these discomforts have been curbed now. What is your perspective of the kind of lack of suffering in 2024? No fault of anyone's, just these creature comforts that we have on forging good firefighters and sailors, for example.
Yeah, that's a great question. I do have one question for you, James, before I jump into that, is the living on the farm. So do you have a lot of memories as like a young kid seeing like your father work on animals, like the gore and the trauma of like animal veterinary care? And like, did that have an imprint on your mind?
I always said that my childhood prepared me for a life as a firefighter. We had the big dining room or kitchen table that everyone would sit around. We'd had all kinds of people walk through the door, literally from extended royalty to gypsies and homeless people. And that's not a, you know, up down scale. That's a horizontal scale in my mind. But yeah, I mean, I would literally be operating on a horse, and we'd stop and we'd have sandwiches, you know, staring at these cuts, and then we'd, you know, wash our hands and then get back to it again. And I obviously wasn't doing, you know, most of the surgical stuff, he was, but I was helping him and passing tools. And so, yeah, when I look at the blood and gore element, I did grow up around that.
Super fascinating. So sorry, I digress. To answer your question, we are trending towards a sicker society. I think the nation at large, especially the United States, is sick mentally and physically on so many levels. And I believe it's because we have grown to be more and more comfortable, and we're not growing and evolving as a species. In order to grow and evolve, you have to be uncomfortable, and you have to be exposed to the elements, to pressure, to whatever stimuli in your environment. And we're just not receiving that. We're getting softer physically and mentally as a society. And I think that the declining health trends we're seeing right now is symptomatic of that overarching societal trend. You know, I think 3/4 of the United States is considered clinically overweight, and over 1/3 is clinically obese. 1 in 5 Americans suffer from some type of diagnosable mental illness. People are more sedentary than they've ever been. Roughly 90% of the US population spends most of their time indoors. It's just crazy. It's sick. It's causing us all to be sick. And it's a problem. It's a huge problem that we have to address.
I just saw a really interesting video. I forget exactly. I think she was a lecturer at Harvard, I believe, but she was talking about, and obviously this is a certain group of people, but how is it that we've got children that have the access to therapy and these conversations, and they're not getting better? And she said, because it's the parents that need the counseling. And I've always said the same thing, you know, people roll their eyes and they'll go, kids today. It's like, well, you fucking raised kids today. My generation, yep, raised their generation. So that means that we're doing something wrong. And so it's okay for us to go, hey, clearly we're not doing it right, but we have to put a stop on all the things that are doing exactly what you talked about. And when COVID happened, I was like, oh, thank God, we got a collective, you know, a captive audience now. We can finally make a dent on this. But as I'm sure you saw, everything that needed to happen, people were told not to do, and everything that was making things worse, they were told to do in spades. So there was no lesson learned. And then as we progress through, people are getting fatter and sicker.
Yeah, it's so, so true. And I was thinking the same thing when COVID hit. I was like, to your point, we have a captive audience, and I think people might start paying attention. And I think some people did. I think there was some good that came out of it, and people had an opportunity to rebound. But for some, it just dug them deeper into a hole.
Absolutely. Well, what about the career aspirations? Obviously, we're going to talk about the SEAL teams and beyond. But when you were in the school age, what were you dreaming of becoming?
I always knew I wanted to be in the military, but I didn't really know about being a SEAL. The wars were kicking off, and I was just eager to like go out and serve. And then, you know, I think subconsciously seeking some type of revenge from the psychological effects that 9/11 had on my family and my father. So I was always eager to get out and go find bad guys. And that's kind of what kicked off that aggression to go serve.
What was your actual experience? You had your dad, he's, you know, served in so many different uniforms. Now he starts struggling like so many of our people do. What did that look like through the son's eyes?
Yeah, great question. A lot of anger and anger and resentment. You know, he like straight up just drank, you know, he just became, he was a functioning alcoholic. He was such a hard worker. And he was a Mason, you know, how most firefighters have a second job. So he was a Mason, and I would work, you know, 12-hour days in the summer with him laying brick and block and stone. And he was just a hard worker. He built our whole house, but he would drink excessively and kind of drink away those negative thoughts and feelings and emotions. And it was mostly reflected in anger. He always cared about us as a family, but you could tell he was struggling. And what was most apparent for me once like I did recognize as when I got older that it was like a big problem was just like his habits and like how unhealthy he became. The drinking led to just poor eating, and the poor eating just led to just like a more weaker lifestyle. He just was making the wrong decisions, like obviously because alcohol prevents you from making the best decisions you can, and it just started to deteriorate. Everything about him led to arguments and fights in the family, things like that.
Did you lose your dad?
No, he's still alive. He's sober now.
Let's
he's 5 years
sober. That's amazing.
He's 5 years sober. So I left for college, and you know, like just real quick, like going back, like he would always share some stuff with the family when he came home, like especially to me and my older brother. He wouldn't really share this to my mom and sister, but you know, he would make comments like, yeah, I just got back from a 24, and you know, some guy got like ran over by a train, and like half of his body was like 100 yards down the track, and he was still talking to me. And like, you know, as a kid, I'm just like, oh, that's cool. Or like, oh, wow. You know, and I didn't really think much of it. Or he would make comments like, yeah, I just shoveled some guy with a flat shovel off the highway from getting in a motorcycle accident. Right. Or like, you know, I remember him saying like a minivan killed, you know, a whole family, like just those types of things. These like unbelievably traumatic events that the average person might only see a couple times in their life at most. Meanwhile, you guys as firefighters see them on a daily basis. And he would always bring those things up. I just never recognized it. And then when I got to college and I got older and I was coming home periodically during like break, I would see like the lawn wasn't mowed and like things just weren't taken care of. And like he was losing his purpose in life because his kids were out of the house and he was getting older. So he was just kind of running out of things to do. And that's when I think it took a really bad turn. So I came home from one of my deployments and my mom said it got really bad. So I flew home and like went and got him to rehab, and a couple times took him to rehab. And just like my last couple of years in the military, I was like coming home and trying to get him in a better place. And then finally, like the fourth or fifth time, he was sober and never looked back. And, you know, just a success story, but it took a lot of effort on like the whole family unit's part to get him the help he needed.
That's amazing to hear. I mean, it really is, especially I think the number of times that you went to rehab. I think this is a big misnomer as well. It's like, well, you know, why aren't you better? You went to rehab. Didn't it work? And what I've heard is usually it's a number of times before people actually, there's just something, because it's, again, death by a thousand cuts. I'm sure it's healing by a thousand cuts too. You just don't walk in and 30 days later, you're healed. It's going to be attempt after attempt until when you have that, you know, perfect storm of all the healthy coping mechanisms and the penny finally drops through the insane fog of, you know, addiction that you first walk in, that you can finally start healing. So I think that's great to hear that it took a number of times. I think a lot of people need to hear that.
And you're rewiring your entire brain. You know, he's been drinking all his life. A lot of us have, right? Alcohol is like so baked into our lifestyle and our culture. Like I've been sober for 3 years now, and like I'm finally like just getting over some of those weird feelings when I go somewhere and I don't have a drink, and all the social aspects surrounding it and the cultural aspects and like people like giving you weird looks, and like I don't care anymore. But when I started, it was hard. You're changing everything about you when you stop drinking alcohol, because it's how we've been raised. You know, I looked up to my dad, and I drank, and I mean, God, I started drinking when I was like 12 or 13 years old in the woods, because I looked up to my dad and I looked up to his friends and my uncles and my grandfathers, and they would drink, and like it would be this manly thing to do, to like go just crush a bunch of beers. And like going into high school, I was just like ass backwards, because I thought that was like cool, you know. So instead of focusing on being a man, I was focusing on trying to be the man, which I thought was drinking alcohol and being a part, you know, like a party rock star. Just totally fucking wrong. Ass backwards.
It is. I'm just about 2 months into a year with no drink, and I'm, you know, hoping that's then going to lead to more. But it was a guest I had on recently. And I'm like, he talked about changing your relationship with alcohol, and I've talked about this for many years. It's the only real vice I had, and it wasn't binge drinking, but it was. If I let it would be, you know, two or three every single night, and I'm disrupting my sleep every single night, and I'm on here talking about how important sleep is. But it's funny, when you stop, you realize every film, every commercial, every social interaction, you know, some of the best food that I sit down with my wife is in a winery. It's really hard not to drink in a winery, but you know, but that's what you have to do. But the moment you shift that perspective, which is really, really hard to do when you first, you know, initiate this, and you realize that you'll have exactly the same interactions with those people with a non-alcoholic drink than you will with an alcoholic drink, all of a sudden, for me, the penny dropped. And I was like, oh, and I've even enjoyed like the alcohol-free IPAs that they have now. It's just enough to kind of that, you know, like the smoker, they got to do something with their hands. But you realize that you don't need the alcohol. And that's a beautiful awakening for me. I'm two months in and already feeling a lot better.
Wow. Wow. That's great. I mean, hey, keep going. That's a lot when your whole life have been part of you. You know, I don't know what the culture was like in England versus America. I heard that like in America, we just are way too sloppy and we just go overboard. Like my wife's from Argentina, and she's like, when she came here, she was like, I don't know why you Americans all of a sudden just like shot, 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 shot. She's like, just have a drink. And like, that's all you need. So
it's that abstinence. It's the crazy backwards way that we hold back alcohol in America. I think, you know, introducing it when you're younger obviously is still introducing it. You know, that's not a question. But if you grew up in Europe, you know, I had wine with Sunday roast, you know, like, or watered down glass, you know, when I was, you know, early, like 11, 12, whatever it was. And so it's not super taboo. So when you start drinking, like, you're not going to see keg stands and beer pong and all that stuff in England. And that's the difference. Here, they're like, oh, you can go join the military, but you can't have a drink. And then at 21, they're like, all right, off to it. And you've just pulled this bow back so hard that when you let go, it's, you know, it's, I don't know, it is, it's a completely different culture. And it's about getting shit-faced rather than the social interaction with a drink. And that's, I think, the difference.
Leave it to us Americans, right?
Well, there's so many things we do well, but I think, yeah, that facade of, you know, holding it back in some of these age limits, but then we let people drive cars at 16. I think we got that backwards.
Yeah, it's, yeah, or, you know, yeah, it's, who knows? But the defining question that really set me for drinking was like, I'm more reliable to the people I like love and truly matter to me when I don't drink alcohol. And that's very personal to me, right? Because I just, you know, some people can just have one single drink, right? But I'm just more reliable, and people around me that I love can count on me better and have the best version of me. And that's the only way I can look at it. So it made it easy for me to stop before it got bad.
Beautiful. Well, I'm so glad to hear about your dad. That's amazing. And that puts hope, you know, in other people. I mean, that kind of career, especially in FDNY, which is a very busy, you know, fire department, to have those struggles and now be 5 years sober, he should be really bloody proud of himself.
Thanks.
All right. Well, then back to your journey. So you want to go into the military. You had an unusual path, though, ultimately into the SEAL team. So let's walk through where you first found yourself.
So I went to the Merchant Marine Academy. That's a federal service academy, like I was saying before. And, you know, there's like the major service academies like West Point, the Naval Academy, the Air Force Academy, and then you have like the Coast Guard Academy. And then the Merchant Marine Academy is kind of like this hidden little gem, and I'll share why in a second, but it was built after World War, or like during World War II, to produce merchant ship officers to drive the ships that were going overseas to both the Pacific and the European theater during World War II, to move, you know, bullets and, you know, supplies, whatever it may be. And, they created the Merchant Marine Academy. So when you're there, you can go one of two ways. You can be an engineer on a ship, or you can be a ship's captain and learn navigation and nautical science and how to drive a ship. And that's the direction that I went. So during your time there, you go to sea for a full year. So you go on a bunch of different merchant ships and naval vessels out for a year and just learn what it's like being out at sea. And then it culminates into your Coast Guard licensing at the end of your senior year. And then you graduate with your unlimited tonnage Coast Guard license. So you can essentially pilot any size vessel in the world. You're commissioned as an officer into any branch of the service, and you leave with your bachelor's degree. So it's a really good deal. And not a lot of people know about it. And so I commissioned, but I chose going into the Navy, and I commissioned with a Naval Special Warfare billet. So I had to go through a couple screening and selection processes as a junior in college out in San Diego. And then they tell you if you get a billet to go to BUDS, which is the beginning of SEAL training. And I got that, and I graduated, and like 2 weeks later drove cross country to Coronado, California to start the journey.
When you look back now, knowing how high the attrition rate is, what was it physically and mentally that allowed you to progress through the selection process when so many rang the bell?
I would say it's my purpose and like my reasoning for going. You know, I think that if you truly, or if you're going for the right reasons and you want to be something like a SEAL for the right reasons, you have a much better shot than like going just because you want to prove yourself or you want to prove for somebody else, or, you know what I mean? Like some people will go cause they just thought they liked the idea of being a SEAL, but they didn't really realize how difficult it really was going to be. And that it's really not that sexy when you're in it. It's pretty brutal, and it's painfully exhausting, and it's a grind. And yeah, it's an incredible experience, but it's extremely hard. And people, I think, just get focused on the like the sex appeal of it rather than the actual like hard work and what it truly means. And those people would disappear very quickly from training. So I think it was just like I had a very important reason to go, and I think that's what allowed me to just kind of push myself through all of it.
I've never thought about this until just now, but we're in the middle of a recruitment crisis in all the branches of the military, first responder professions. And one thing that I've said about the fire service, because obviously that's the environment that I know, is some agencies are like, well, yeah, we can still hire. We're still getting numbers. And I said, well, yeah, but that's all well and good, but you're getting the entire list now. You used to be able to choose the top 10 or 20 before. And I think this is a key element. If it's very competitive, you end up with men and women who have a burning desire to be a firefighter or a SEAL, whatever the thing is. If you then lower standards continuously, you lose those people. And it's that burning why that is going to make you compassionate when you're exhausted. And also it's going to be that one that's going to push you through that hallway looking for that kid when you're fucking terrified.
Yep. Yes. And that unfortunately, without getting too political, but like that ideology is plaguing so many different institutions across the world right now. And I think people get confused between equal opportunity versus equal outcome. And like, you're never going to be able to defeat the hierarchy, right? Some people, or the bell curve, however you want to say it, some people are just going to be better fit for the job than others. And diversity is very important. But when you are in a high performance position, or if you're a firefighter, I don't care what color skin you have. I don't care what religion you follow. I don't care if you're a man or a woman. All I care about is that you can drag my big ass out of a burning building. And that's what it's about. So line everybody up, and whoever can consistently drag somebody out of a burning building and do it in a team environment and not lose their shit, those are the people that we have to pick. And it just, the same concept applies everywhere else in the world. And if we lose touch with that, especially as first responders and military, we're deteriorating ourselves, as you know, we're just like lowering the, it's a sad situation. And I think, to your point, when you first brought this up, like, that's why we're seeing attrition in numbers, and recruiters are having an issue bringing people in. It's like, people are now looking at the military. I mean, I'm saying this, maybe this is a generalization, but a lot of people look at the military and it's not as prestige as they once thought it might be. You know, they're getting a lot of like negative press because they're trying all these weird things. You know, something smart is like, you don't want to have a transvestite promote military, and you don't want those types of people being the face of the military, right? And that's what they were trying to do, and they saw a tremendous backlash, right? It's just like, don't do that, right? Like, you're recruiting for performance, and you're recruiting to bring the right people in, and they're just seem to be getting it wrong.
I think the other issue is that people are seeing the support, the rest and recovery that is or is not there in these professions. So for example, you know, you're in the military, and I hear this over and over again, this is third hand because I'm not a military member myself, but the number of people that say, you know, then they got into the VA system, and then they got pills thrown at them, and then they almost took their own life. And then we have an amazing conversation about their, thank God, healing journey and what they're doing now. And it's the same in my profession. You know, when I went in blindly going, I'm going to go help people. This is what I want to do. Totally unaware of what mandatory overtime was, and marriages and cancers and suicides and overdoses and all the things. And so now a young candidate looks at that and they get everything. So it's 2024. When you do your research, everything pops up. And so, and then they look at the pay, and they look at, you know, the work week and all these things. And they're like, I don't think I want to do that. That doesn't sound very good. I want to serve. I'll find a different way of serving. The beautiful thing is that all you have to do is fix those things. Like, don't withdraw from Afghanistan in a day while Marines get, you know, blown up to death. You know, so we lose Marines to explosions and we suddenly leave. That's not telling everyone that served, everyone that lost limbs, everyone that brought home traumatic memories and brought home their friends in caskets covered in flags, that we're there to support you and we believe in the mission. So we have the opportunity to fix all these things. But like you said, shiny objects like, you know, the PC elements that are front page on whatever newspaper is not what it's about. Supporting men and women, warfighters, regardless of gender and all the other things, but people that are supposed to be there. And if you give a selfless, you know, service, that we will take care of you. That is how we fix recruiting. But if you say, oh, I need 20% of this color and this religion and this sexuality, you're completely missing the fucking point. You will have people lining up around the door of all those different, you know, backgrounds if you just show them that you actually give a shit.
Yep. Yeah. 100%, and I think it doesn't do people, minorities, it doesn't do them a service either, because now we talked about imposter syndrome, right? Now they might be asking themselves, like, did I get here just because I am this color, or I am this religion, or, you know what I mean? And like, there's some, like, I believe that there's smart there's smart ways to do it, right? Like, I would understand if you're in a predominantly black neighborhood, right, and you wanted to have more diversity in your police officers in the neighborhood, like, that's a reasonable thing, right? Like, there's a reason behind that, like a performance-based, technically a reason. But you can't, but at the same time, you can't jeopardize the performance, right? Like, you have to find the people that can first do the job, that can carry a weapon, that can, you know, sprint 100 meters to take down a perpetrator, whatever it is, right? Or pull somebody out of the building.
The African Americans are going to be a lot better than us white guys on that part. Let's be honest.
<That's> it.
When it right. comes to sprinting, they're going to be kicking our ass.
Right. Yep. And so I think we just need to do a smarter job. And it's a turbulent world right now out there, you know. So I don't get much involved with it. I just hope that we can hold the standard high for our guardian communities and make sure that people don't fail to recognize that at the end of the day there's a job to be done, and we need to pick the best people that can do that job, and that's a good starting point.
To me, the mentorship programs are the answer to that. There's clearly history of certain groups not being brought in, or just simply the barrier to entry. You know, like, for example, most of the fire departments in America, you've got to pay to go to fire school and EMT school, and then you test. Well, if you haven't got,
right,
you know, $4,000 or $5,000, that's a barrier to entry. One of my friends
right.
here started a mentorship program for firefighters, and they go into the underserved populations and they let them know, and it's free training. And then there's scholarships that can be awarded for Fire Academy. And then you get the people from these different backgrounds and allow them to rise up. And within that group, there are going to be some like, nope, you would have been a terrible firefighter. Just, you know, I think accounting is the right thing for you. But you're going to find, like you said, the best candidates, because it's not about, oh, I need these people that look this way. It's this group is not being represented as well. Like you said, there's some populations where speaking Spanish or being from certain backgrounds is absolutely going to be an asset. So
right.
go into that community and find the best candidates and give them the training
right.
so they can rise up to that bar. You don't just go in and scoop a bunch of them up and say, you're all coming with me,
right.
of which some are going to be rock stars and some are going to be problem children.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I am all for equal opportunity. Like, we need more organizations like that, that can go into minority communities and underserved communities and give them a better opportunity. Like, I love that. That's, I would put my money into that. And I'm a firm believer of that. It's just, there's only so far you can go once, you know, like to meet a standard. So I'm glad to hear that there are organizations like that. I think it's really important.
Yeah. Well, this is the irony, is that for all these problems, there are such easy solutions, but they're in the middle and no one wants to look in the middle these days.
Yep.
All right. Well, then you mentioned about going through buds. So talk to me about deployments. I know you didn't find yourself in the Middle East specifically. So where on planet Earth did you find yourself serving?
Yeah. So I've been to the Middle East, but I didn't really experience combat in the Middle East. My combat experiences were in Africa, in Somalia. So that's where I really had the opportunity to like do SEAL stuff. At the time, it was probably 2016, 2017, like the war was dying down in the Middle East, and there was this weird uptick of that terrorist group called Al-Shabaab, if you're familiar with them.
Yep.
And they were just the ones wreaking havoc on all the resorts and stuff all in like East Africa and West Africa. And, you know, that's what really my counterterrorism career was. You know, I don't have this crazy history of sustained combat operations like a lot of guys do that, you know, got in the early 2000s and just rode the whole war for 20 years. I'm not saying I wish I had that, because a lot of those guys are hurting real hard now or no longer with us. But, you know, I just, timing wise, I just never ended up deploying to a combat zone in the Middle East. It was just in Africa.
What was the element? What did it look like? Because I know, for example, my wife's half Filipina, and you know, you look at the Philippines, they actually have a lot of, you know, extremism there, a lot of violence. When it comes to the areas that you worked in, obviously, I think of the mall shooting in Kenya and the one, I forget his name, the one SDS guy that went in and helped mitigate that with some of the guys he was teaching. But what were you seeing as far as the level of extremism, and where was the root cause of that in that particular part of the continent?
Yeah, so it was very different from, like, you know, like at the same time, my buddies that I, you know, went through training, right? Some of us went to the East Coast, some of us went to the West Coast, and my guys that went to the West Coast, they would go to Iraq, and they were, you know, in the second taking of Mosul, they were in cities and like very urban environments, and they would talk to me about like kind of the warfare that was going on there. Very different than what we were seeing in East Africa. It was like open desert, small villages, right? Very like rural areas, probably what you would more see in like Afghanistan. And you know, it was, I would say, your garden variety, brutal terrorism, you know, bombs, children, just like really cheap low blows, to communities. Like we would, you know, go from one village to the next and we would see like some of the atrocities that they would commit. You know, they were just cutthroat. They would, at that time, they were using a lot of like IEDs, and their tactics were pretty much like shoot at you and run away type thing and draw you in. So I don't think it was like anything far off from what you were seeing in the Middle East, just more spread out. There was like this big valley called the Juba River Valley, and we were part of like this Juba River offensive, and we were working with like some of the foreign nationals, and we would take them out to target, try to have them fight for their own country and go out there and kind of move them up to a target, and then let them go into the house. And, you know, if the house gets hot, then we would figure out a way to help them if we can. But at the same time, we're not going to have Americans die on African soil for another country, even though there's like a grander play for the whole continent of Africa, which is a whole nother thing right now. But yeah, like America very much didn't want to show that we were really getting involved over there. And like, I think the camp next to me, a couple, I don't know, maybe 100 miles away at another outpost, I was out in this place called Kismayo that was like in the middle of nowhere, and there was one other outpost that was nearby, and then our next closest was like Mogadishu. A SEAL was killed, and that like sparked a big uprising, and they're like, why are we doing stuff, you know, over in East Africa? And people were like wondering, what are we doing over there? So it wasn't like the best press. And I think we've really toned things down kind of operating out of that area now.
What about root causes? I know one thing I heard, I saw on a documentary, and it was talking about the overfishing of Somalian seas and that causing more poverty because the fishermen weren't able to make a living anymore in their own shores. What did you see as far as the contributing factors to allowing this kind of extremism to grow in Somalia specifically?
Money and corruption, I'd say. Just money and like the form of extremism. Like it's a combination of a really strong ideology plus like just money hungry. Just being like a rotten human being at its core. Bringing out all the worst of human nature. But I think mostly, you know, religion plus power and money hungry, and probably just fear of poverty, just like riding the wave of avoiding what probably generations and generations of their predecessors dealt with, which is like poverty, you know. Like I don't want to say I feel bad for terrorists, but you know, there's a reason why they're a terrorist, right? And it's not because they woke up one day and they're just like, I want to kill. It's like because they were raised that way, you know, and no one likes to say that. You know who Jordan Peterson is?
Yes.
He he wrote a book called Maps of Meaning. And one of his big pushes was like, if I was born in Nazi Germany, I'm probably gonna get harassed for this, but if I was born in Nazi Germany, right? Like right at the start of World War II, I would probably be, you know, in the SS, or I probably would have jumped into, right? I can't say for sure that I would have had this moral objection to joining an entire, you know, the Third Reich. Like, I can't say that. I could only assume, like, maybe I would realize what was going on, but most people at that time were just fed into this movement and this ideology, and they believed every bit of it. So the idea is that if you were born in Nazi Germany, there's a chance you might be at a concentration camp doing horrific, atrocious activities, right? And for you to say not, like, that's just a, you know, just making assumptions.
Yeah. Well, I think that's why it's so important to talk about environment and talk about the root cause of things. You know, as you mentioned, 70% of the U.S. is obese or overweight, and a third is obese, which is terrifying because that's a significant, you know, level of being overweight. And, you know, there's a lot of that. Well, if they just woke up at 4 and, you know, took an ice bath and then went for a 10-mile run, they could be slim like me bullshit. And it's like, yeah, but also if they grew up in Manhattan and their only source of food was the bodega and all the freaking, you know, playing areas are kind of riddled with gangs, can I compare as an English farm boy that had an orchard the same with that kid in Brooklyn? You know, no, I can't. It's not fair. So right. It's environment as well. So, but when you actually take that into account, or immigration from Mexico, drug prohibition has caused a lot of the issues. So that's one of the root causes, you know. So if we're not having that conversation and we're just building walls to keep the Mexicans out, we're missing the fucking point of why all these people are fleeing their country. So I think it's so important to kind of reverse engineer some of these.
Yes. Yes. Environment. You said it best. It's such an important thing. And I grew up as a, you know, middle class. I had access to sports. I had a strong family unit, right? And I'm blessed in how I grew up, and it's not the case for others. So always considering that environment, and how do you modify the environment, modify the information environment, especially nowadays, to give people, number one, the benefit of the doubt and give them as many resources as you can. Because a lot of it is people just don't know, right? If you're a, you know, single mom with three kids and you work, you know, 50, 60 hours a week, and your kids go to school and they come home and all you can do is grab fast food because you don't have time to cook, like how do you crack that, you know? Education, but at the same time, there's no more time in the day for that mother to cook for her kids and stuff. So it's such a big problem. I don't know how to like address it. But I think you can start by changing institutions, you know, and it's a long road.
Yeah. Well, I think, again, it's, you know, it's getting people educated and angry, getting to understand first. And if you look at, you know, for example, the origin story of drug prohibition, it's on racism and job justification. Harry Anslinger, that's how it all started. And we've had a, you know, 90 plus year longitudinal study of its effectiveness, and it's a fucking disaster. And now we've got, you know, streets riddled with gangs and homelessness and overdoses and sex workers. And a large part of that is this ridiculous law that they put in the 30s. So if we actually have the guts to address that, and then as we sit here now recording, MDMA was just refused as a psychedelic therapy by the FDA, the same FDA that approved OxyContin, which caused the fucking opioid crisis. This is a problem. If we just sit back and allow these people that work for us to negatively impact our environment, we are going to get fatter and sicker. But if we get educated and angry and push the fuck back, we can actually turn it around.
That was a hard hit. I don't know how you know, what your stance or how much into the world of psychedelics you are, but I was really, that was really disheartening.
Yeah, it was disgusting. And again, this whole prohibition conversation, I talk about this all the time. I know so many people now. I mean, I've obviously found myself, you know, immersed in the SEAL community from a firefighter's perspective. So many of my SEAL friends, it's psychedelics that saved their lives. A lot of my first responder friends, the same. And so these men and women that serve within this country or serve to protect it from overseas then go have to go to another country to get the therapy for it. It makes no sense whatsoever.
No, it's messed up. I went down to Mexico. You ever hear of vets?
Yeah, I had Marcus on the show.
Oh, you had Marcus on the show. That's right. Yeah. So I went down back in 2020 down to Mexico and went through that program. I met Marcus in San Diego. You know, the organization was kind of, I don't want to say in its infant stages, but it was still pretty small. And then now it's grown so much and they've done so much good work. But that changed the course of my life, being introduced to psychedelics in that professional setting that they offer. And now I look on how many people I've been able to help based on my experience. It's more powerful than I would argue any other medication and any other modality of healing to this day. And if I were to put all my bets on something for actually being able to turn the tide of this mental illness crisis we're dealing with, it would be psychedelics.
100%.
Period. No ifs, ands, or buts.
Well, I want to get to your transition story and then we'll talk about the downward spiral and then getting yourself out again. But just before we do, when I talk to anyone who's been deployed and actually seen combat, you've kind of answered one side, like you said, some of the atrocities that you saw. But when it comes to our perspective through the TV, it's either one of two perspectives. It's either, you know, the kind of tactical kill them all, let God sort them out, stacking bodies on one side, or it's they're all baby killers on the other. And the middle are our men and women in uniform that are actually over there. You know, they're the ones you should be asking. You talked about the kind of, you know, justification of why we were there in certain situations. The other side of the coin I like to ask as well, though, is kindness and compassion. People don't hear that on the news at all, what our actual men and women in military do, whether it's in their role or whether it's above and beyond. So when you think back to service, what were moments of kindness and compassion you remember?
Yeah, so I would say the first like real dead body that like the first like real like traumatic injury I've seen on somebody was like a younger boy who was probably, I don't know, 15 or 16 years old. And he just started like, he was like in the militia and he got both of his legs blown off. He died, but he had both of his legs blown off and like part of his torso was gone. And I remember I was next to a medic who was working on him. And I think we just hit him with some ketamine just to kind of let him ride it out. And there was one of his buddies was next to him and was holding him. And I don't know what they were saying, but it was so genuine and so pure. And his buddy was so like just pure and saying, he probably was saying something like, I'm going to tell your parents something, or like, I'm going to carry some information onto your family. And he put like this level of comfort in the kid's eyes that, you know, I could just feel and see. And it was like very saddening and disheartening, but at the same time, you could tell that they were fighting for something that was deeply meaningful to them. And like from a spiritual level, he was able to like kind of pass him off in the heaven type thing. And I remember like very vividly that memory. So I think there was just like, I just had a whole another level of compassion for people that are in war zones in like third world countries. And like their fight is so much bigger than ours. We as Americans, I keep shitting on Americans, but like the smaller you define your world, the bigger your problems seem. And we like to define our world very tiny, day to day. And, oh, I don't have Wi-Fi in the airplane or whatever it may be. It's raining out and I can't go out now. And these people are dealing with life or death situations. And those are big problems to have, right? We deal with small problems mostly on a daily basis. So that was probably like a very meaningful, impactful way to just have more compassion for people that are not here in the United States that are going through a lot more than we are. Suck it up, Buttercup.
One of the things, this is an absolute utopian pipe dream, but you know, there's that term Team America World Police, and one of the best films ever made, I think. But you know, that that kind of idea that we're out policing the world. And I think that I love the fact that we have the potential for really doing good in the world, but it's not through policing. And don't get me wrong, there's times where we have to send, you know, military members over there, and you know, we've got to do what we got to do. But imagine if we took the time to fix some of the issues in our own country, the good that we could do then outside of our own borders, because we do have things we need to fix. I mean, our children are getting murdered in the schools, and you know, the lifespan of this 70% that's overweight or obese is significantly shorter than it should be. So these are very, very important issues to address. But imagine then if we reversed, you know, drug prohibition, and we started taking some power away from the cartels, and you know, there's so many good things that we could do that then through diplomacy, we could actually start positively affecting some of these other countries. I mean, Haiti is a perfect example.
Yeah.
It's my neighbor here in Florida. And the fact that there's a war zone across the water when it could be the most affluent tourist destination and the Haitian people could be flourishing is an absolute travesty to me. So I think if we actually, they say, you want to change the world, start at home. If we all look within our four walls, made a difference, and step outside our front door and then help our community, collectively, that would extend to the entire world.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well said, James. You're a bit of a philosopher, huh?
I've had almost 1,000 conversations. It's made me think about a lot of stuff, put it that way.
Yeah. I can't wrap my head around that stuff, honestly. It's so complex. Like, how do you, like, you know, drugs and, you know, the fentanyl, like all these different things. Like, I don't know where to start. Like, you look at the healthcare system, you look at poverty, you look at prison systems, you look at our political narrative overseas and why we're there. It's just so complex and everything's so connected that I don't know where to begin.
Yeah. Well, I think firstly, you got to turn the pyramid upside down, remind the people that they're at the top. That's where it begins.
There you go.
But if you keep getting divided and told that, you know, the other really fucking awful leader is your enemy, and you're being dissuaded from the fact that the awful leader that you hold as your messiah is also terrible. If we can debunk that myth, and that, you know, no good leaders are making it to that position in the first place, that's how we start. And if we allow ourselves to be divided and fight for people that should never have been in that position in the first place, then we're gonna reap what we sow. So we need an awakening first.
Yep. Well said.
All right. Well, then you mentioned obviously Ibogaine. So let's kind of reverse engineer. A lot of the people I've had on the show, the transition is where people really start to struggle. There's some that have a great transition, but you've gone from this tight-knit tribe, this really, you know, laser-focused purpose, you know, this identity as a SEAL or a firefighter. And then one day your ID doesn't work, you know, the doors are closed behind you and you find yourself on the other side. And I know for a lot of people that can be very jarring. So what was your transition story? And then talk to me about the slide downwards first.
Yeah. So, you know, you brought up a couple of the areas where we fall on our faces as military and really first responders after transition. And for me personally, it was mostly identity crisis and like their of lack of mission and purpose in life. And then two is like TBI, traumatic brain injury stuff. And like, you know, my whole life I've played sports, combat sports, and like in the military, I got my bell rung so many times being around explosions and gunfire. And I remember hitting my head really hard once before I got out. And anyway, so that is what I believe caused a lot of my like mental health issues. So those two things, the TBI stuff that just carried through my whole life, military career, and then the transition out of being in like such a high performing job and then leaving that environment and going into like the corporate world. It's like so foreign and so confusing because like everyone just cares about money and like they'll stab you right in the back if it accomplishes their agenda. So that was like a big slap in the face for me. And I always like to say that, like, I truly don't, like, the doctor tells me I have PTSD, but, like, I truly do not believe that I have PTSD, but they say I do. I really don't. Like, I don't have, like, at least I don't think I probably have, like, the, what do they call it? Like, hypervigilance. We all have that, right? Like, you have that. Like, you're always on high alert, but, like, so what? Like, that's who I am as a person. But I don't, like, have, like, I don't have this, like, deep state of depression, anxiety, necessarily that caused, like, my mental illness. It's more so stuff that, like, is so deeply rooted in my brain, I think, again, from partly from TBI stuff, and then just that loss of identity and the rug being pulled from underneath me that really put me in that dark, dark place. And I digress. What I was saying before is, just because you have trauma doesn't mean that you are going to have mental illness. Trauma, I think, has been around for thousands of years, since the inception of mankind. And I think it's how we handle trauma and all the other things in the 21st century that exacerbate trauma. Like, I believe we should be able to go to war and see dead bodies and kill people and lose friends and come back and still be healthy. I believe that should be a thing, but society is so twisted and there's so many pitfalls that we fall into those pitfalls that society just creates. And then all of our shit that we carry with us just exacerbates all of it. And we just fall into this cascading cycle. So that's what I believe happened to me. Most importantly, I can't speak for other people, but I would throw a highly educated guess out there that that's a big cause of it. And I started just, like, drinking excessively, like the substance abuse, just abusing everything. And that is what spun me into a dark, dark place.
When I spoke to Sebastian Junger, he's been on the show a few times now, and the one book, Tribe, one of the big things he talks about is story. And obviously, this is what this whole podcast is about. But when you look at older, tribal communities, when the warriors came home, there would be a ceremony and they would tell what they did, you know, and it would be celebrated, and, you know, there'd be a way of kind of offloading it. And there would be, I'm sure, an appreciation from the village, whether it was hunting, whether it was actually war. And so, you know, you have that kind of healing element. And I think this is so clearly underlined. If you look at the Vietnam era veterans, of which I've had several on, you know, they were spat on or pissed on, or all kinds of stories I've heard, and they weren't received well. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that a large percentage of our suicide, you know, military members are Vietnam era veterans, because they're coming out of whatever job they flung themselves into to try and forget, and now they're retiring, and now we're seeing a lot from that point too. But that ability to tell the world, you know, I love Sebastian's thing. He's because of the Veterans Town Hall, which you literally allow your veterans in your community to tell them what they did. Were they, you know, were they pro-military, were they anti-military, whatever it is, give them a voice. But coming home and then being told to shut up, you know, that's so detrimental in modern day society.
Yes. Tribe. What was it? Some Indian. Would you remember what it was? What tribe it was?
He talked about it.
Iroquois. Yep. Yeah, exactly. I remember that. That was such a good book. I read that a while ago, but that's such a good book. He really hit some salient points in that. Yeah. Yeah, I think trauma is part of life.
100%. Well, you talked about coming back and then drinking. So where was the lowest point that you found yourself? So many people on here got to that suicide ideation. Did you find yourself there?
Yep. So two situations that ring true to me. One is, one morning backtrack related to alcohol. I went out. This was like, this was St. Paddy's Day leading into COVID. And I went out and I got so drunk, blackout drunk. And long story short, I ended up at like a deli at like 4 a.m. And there was like, just to make the story short, there was like a girl fight going on. And like, I was trying to, you know, the protector I am, I was trying to break it up and like say, like, stop fighting girls. And there was like a group of four or five guys there, and more or less they jumped me. One of them sucker punched me, and I started fighting them, and one of them just like punted me, booted me in the face when I was on the ground with one of them and knocked me out cold into a pool of blood. And my friend was in the car waiting for me to like get a sandwich and like saw everyone run out because they thought I was probably dead. And I was laying there in a pool of my own blood, you know, at like, I don't know, 29, 30 years old. And, I, you know, I woke up the next day and my jaw was all jacked up and, you know, like my inside of my mouth was cut up. And I was living at my parents' house because I moved home like, I don't know, a couple months before, and I was building a house next door to my parents. And I remember like I came home and my mom looked at me and she started crying. And I was just like, what am I doing with my life? And that's when I was just like really in a bad place. And I was just like, I just was walking around with just insane amount of anger and energy. And a couple days after that, I woke up one morning and I literally was like, why am I even awake? I like was like, I have no reason to be alive. And I don't know if you have or other people on your show, I'm sure have. It's like comparable to like a panic attack, but your thoughts start cycling down into a really dark place. And I had that moment and it scared the shit out of me because I was headed down this suicidal ideating pathway. And my thoughts started going down to, well, maybe I could just not be here anymore, more or less. And that's when I hit a really bad point. And I think what pulled me out of it that morning was the fact that I still had a choice. I don't know if that sounds like a little, I had a choice, which to me is like the most powerful thing in the whole world. It's like, if you have choice, you have free will to choose to do something, whether or not that's killing yourself or sucking it up and moving forward. I had a choice and there was something in me. I don't know what it was. You can call it God, you could call it the universe, but I had this like just jolt of energy of like, no, I have a choice here. And like if I have a choice, there is a choice. And I have one of two things. I can go down that dark path or I can just like step up and move. And that's what I did. And I just started moving. And the first thing I did was I got a dog. I drove out to Missouri and I picked up a dog because they've been a part of my life. And I hadn't had one when I was in the military because I couldn't take care of a dog. And I went and picked up a dog. And that just gave me an anchor. And I held on to that. I woke up. I could feed the dog. I trained the dog. I walked the dog. And that gave me that first bit of release and like connecting me back to reality.
When I first started this podcast, and one of my friends, Dustin Hawkins, is probably the first person that really like bore his soul on the show. And that was, you know, God, 7 years ago now. I started seeing this commonality come out because after 1,000 interviews, you know, the kind of proverbial Venn diagram is spitting out some pretty, you know, truth bombs, if you like. But one of the ones that I never heard anyone really discussing when it comes to mental health, and certainly not on the posters and all that kind of thing, was this feeling of burdensome. Almost everyone that had been at that point, there was such a miswiring through all the things, childhood trauma, unaddressed childhood trauma, the things that we see in uniform, you know, the organizational betrayal, the side effects of alcohol and psych meds and all the other things, the perfect storm, that the brain was miswired, the reality was distorted. And you have these men and women who are wearing a uniform that they swore they would die for a complete stranger. And now there's this intrinsic belief, this true belief that I am the cause for my family's pain. And if I just take myself out, and which ironically makes suicide a very selfless, kind and compassionate act in that moment, in their truth, even though from a healthy mind looking in, it's obviously distorted completely. Did you have any of those voices start to creep in when you were at that point?
No, because I was a bachelor. I was single. I was like at my parents. So like nobody was counting on me. So if I had a family, then I think that would probably be some of my thought. If I was hurting people around me, or I would have that burdensome feeling. And I appreciate you bringing light to what goes on in the mind of somebody that is suicidal. And like people are like, oh, that's selfish. And, you know, they're, you know, getting the easy way out. It's like, no, their brain is so contorted that they think up is down and you know, left is right. So I appreciate you bringing that up because you get a lot of that. And I think it's just the wrong way to look at it.
Yeah, no, it is. And this is the problem. And I'll give you a perfect example. I think it was about a year ago now in Florida. We had a young couple. They were both law enforcement officers. The boyfriend took his own life first, and they had a not quite a newborn, but an infant child. And then the girlfriend took her life. I think it was a week later. So from the outside looking in, you're like selfish, you know, all the things. But then you, at that, you know, when you kind of look at how distorted a mind can get through all of these, you know, negative impacts, again, there must have been a truth that this kid is doomed if I keep doing what I'm going to do. So I'm going to take myself out of the picture. So hard to understand, especially now because that child has neither parent. And this is why we have to bring this up to the front, I think, that when that mind is miswired, and I say that, you know, broken compassionately, that needs to be a big red flag to hold their hand and pull them out of that psychosis back into to reality again. Because reality is obviously you're going to leave all the pain with that person you leave behind. But at that moment, they're the cause of the pain. That suicide must be fucking terrifying for them. And they do it anyway.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Well said, James. Well said.
So let's talk about the beautiful hope that is healing. Because as you talked about, you know, there's trauma at war. We've had trauma since the beginning, you know, the dawn of time and the birth of man. Where I think there's so much hope in this conversation is understanding that if you do the work, the other side of that is a better version of yourself. Another thing that we don't really hear in the mental health conversation. So what were the tools that you started finding? You mentioned a dog, and I've got one right outside my office door here. I couldn't agree more with that. All of a sudden, you've got purpose. There's another being that relies on you getting outside and moving. You mentioned as well Ibogaine. So walk me through your healing journey, and then what was that metamorphosis for you?
Yeah, so I got a dog, and then I probably had a month or two with the dog, and it really, again, just anchored me down. And then I found out about vets, and I had a buddy that actually went through, and I was talking to him, and he's like, you should go here. So he called up, I think, Marcus and Amber, and got me a spot. So I went down. Again, this was during COVID. So I went down to Mexico and, you know, really ripped the Band-Aid off with the Ibogaine 5-MeO DMT experience, which was designed for that very reason, for people that have hard heads and are stubborn, you know, former special operators. So that was, you know, short of the birth of my children, the most powerful, meaningful experience of my life. That rewired my brain and sat me back down and put me in a much better place. And then I started getting to work, like really getting to work. Spending a tremendous amount of time outside in nature and hiking and being outdoors and just getting myself out of the car and out of the office, and also listening to music. I started playing a little bit of music, but I never really was able to pick it up in a meaningful, habitual way. But listening to music and using music as not just an outlet, but as a way to process my emotions was a really powerful thing. And, you know, what the feeling that you get turning on the radio and listening to like your favorite song, like that's an incredible dopamine rush. Like where, other than like hard drugs, like where else can you get that feeling of like listening to like your favorite song on the radio? It's incredible. It just shakes you to your core. So clearly there's some real value and magic with music that I think we need to do a better job studying. But the music, the nature, the dog, and I would say the biggest one was connecting with other people that were struggling similarly and just having that peer companionship with others. And those things all combined gave me, you know, there's things like exercise and diet that were important as well, but I got to work. I worked hard. There's no other way to put it. I brought people into my life. I started changing my habits. I started getting rid of the bad stuff. You know, I had to work hard to get myself back in a better place. There's no shortcut.
So many people that have been through, you know, their journey of suffering, and then they come out the other end, also find themselves as a beacon of light. And people that they thought were absolutely fine are coming to them saying, I'm not fine. Did you have that as you started kind of coming out the other side?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, if there's one thing I'm good at is bringing light to people that are in the dark. That's who I am as a person. And I've helped a lot of people that were in very dark places. Some close friends, I've lost some friends to suicide and people close to me. Yeah, can't grab everybody, but there is hope and there's light. And if you can just give somebody a little taste of it, that's like the first step. And that's the first start. And it could be something as simple as like me sitting down with you face to face in person, putting my hand on your shoulder and saying, it's going to be okay. It's good out there. I promise you, like all this bad stuff you're dealing with, like, yeah, it's hard. It's heavy. I know I've been there, but I promise you that there's actually some really good stuff out there. You just got to find it and you got to work hard to find it. And once you get there, it's the most amazing place in the world. You know, it takes that sometimes. Sometimes it's just some people have their own, what do they call them? You know, like spiritual experience with or without psychedelics, where they have this moment of clarity where they're just like, they see the light, you know, and they see that little glimmer of hope or that little clearing in the trees. It's there. And once you get there, it's so good. It's so good.
Well, I think this is where the real resilience conversation comes. And in my arena, there are some people, friends of mine, that put on, you know, resilience building exercises, and they'll do firefighter, you know, scenarios, and they'll have, you know, music playing really loud and strobes and all that stuff. And I think that that's kind of like, you know, overcoming stress. But I think the real resilience conversation is the shit that bothers you now. When you work through it, that becomes, you know, a positive scar, that becomes a badge of honor, it becomes strength, I think. And so, you know, when you've gone through this, for example, and now you get to storytell about how you got at the other end, that's a superpower. It really is. And you really are a better version of yourself. So getting people inspired and excited to do the work, because it's not, and I've talked about this a lot, I feel like some of the conversations in the mental health space are like, well, I've just lived with my PTSD. You know, I've got my dog, and you know, and it becomes like an identity, and you get stuck in that point, rather than, yeah, take your dog all the way through to when you're, you know, you don't have to have the labels over anymore. You're just out there enjoying being with your dog, but you are a better version of yourself. And I don't know if I can overstate that enough. If you can show someone that you 2.0 is waiting on the other side of the work that you've got to do, whatever that looks like, that is going to drag people, especially that, you know, mission-driven people like first responders and military, that's going to drive them through. But if it's just a message of, well, I live with, then they'll be like, well, then what's the point of living? If I'm just going to be living, waking up feeling the same fucking way every morning. But if you're now out there creating nonprofits and leading, you know, retreats and doing all the things, now all of a sudden that's exciting. So I think that has to be put forefront, is that post-traumatic growth conversation.
Yes, yes, yes. The only way is up. The only way is up. And something is better than nothing. Like if you're just sitting there and eating it, or you find yourself just, to your point, just being in that mental health conversation where you're like, well, this is how it's going to be. I'm going to be miserable for the rest of my life. No, that's a victim mindset. Get off the couch and start moving and doing stuff. And I say that because I know how hard it can be getting off the couch, and I've been there. But you got to move. You can't stop, and you have to do something. Even if it's one little step at a time, like it's, if you stop moving, that's where it gets real bad. When I say stop moving, I mean more like when you stop trying, when you don't make that conscious choice to get better, that's when it gets bad.
Absolutely. Well, obviously, to take those first few steps, having people around you is a massive part. So talk to me about what made you start Guardian Revival, and let's unpack the pillars of your organization.
Yeah, so once I got myself in a really good place, just knowing my father and his experience, and knowing other first responders and how challenging it is for them, my uncles, my cousins, I wanted to do something, and animals, music, nature, and peer support were so powerful and they worked so well for me, and they have such a sturdy history of research, both anecdotally and clinically, of their success as healing modalities, that I was like, I have to scale this and we have to do something. We have to build programs and services that can help other people. And that's really the birth of Guardian Revival, the organization that I run today. We give people hope and help them heal through those elements. And starting a nonprofit and running a business is a whole thing in of itself. It causes its own stresses, but hey, that's the sacrifice you make, right? Staying up at night and working the late hours and not, and worrying about if money's going to come in, and like, you know, at the end of the day, I'm sacrificing because I know how much these things can help other people. So that's the world I live in now. I grind at Guardian Revival to try to scale these things so other people can benefit.
One of the kind of forgotten groups of first responder or military is our families. You know, I think this is an important part of the conversation, because we are doing the thing, but they're either holding down the fort while we're doing the thing, or we come back home still carrying the thing and they have to deal with us. So talk to me about the home front element.
Yeah. So our newest program is called Guardian Home Front, which is for the families of our guardians. And this was a long time coming. And to your point, our families are the direct recipients of the trauma that we experience day in and day out. And they're never at the forefront, right? Military families are always moving because they're, you know, military family member is the one that's getting pushed all around the country, and they're kind of left to the wayside. So it goes both ways too. If you have a family that's healthy and supportive, like, you know this with your wife, if your wife's good, you're that much better. You know, like, if she's in a bad place, then it makes it harder for you. So like, you have a sturdy family, the family unit is in harmony, that guardian is going to be much better off. So they complement each other.
So what about the music element? When you talked about that, I mean, I've been just finished writing my second book, and I want to make it into a TV show, which, again, lofty goals. Wow. But, you know, if Tiger King can get made, anything can get made. So, but the music is so important. When I'm writing these chapters, I'm like, this would be what was playing in the background. This would be for this scene. And it does. Yeah. It emotes, you know, I mean, it adds so much to, a scene on film as well. So talk to me about using music to help, you know, these first responders and military heal, because that's not an area that I usually hear when it comes to these nonprofits.
Right. So at Guardian, we have three different pillars of that program. One is jams. So it's like a community-based music session once a week where veterans and first responders get together and just play music. We also do retreats. So those are like multi-day, fully immersive music experiences. And then we do something called tracks, which is like the professional music experience, where we take a guardian and get them trained up on vocals and instrumentals and bring them into our studio and record them professionally and put them on our label on Spotify, Apple Music, and Amazon Music. So those are like the three ways that we leverage music to help heal others. And like, if we really want to help a population of 20, 50 million guardians, however much it adds up to with military and first responders, you need something that's like very scalable and accessible and has a low barrier to entry. Anybody can pick up a pair of headphones. Everyone has a phone, and you can pick up a pair of headphones and listen to music and then maybe have a debrief with somebody or talk about it or write about it. Right. I mean, we've played music walking into battle, right? We've played music after battle to reconcile with the horrors of what we saw. Like, music has been around forever. Like, there's crazy, without getting too much into the spirit world, there's this crazy like synchronous vibrations with like geometric shapes that we have in our body and the way our brain works based on like different chords of music and different vibrations, and there's just so much connected with music in the human body, and I think we've just started to explore that.
What about Hawaii? I see that you mentioned that on the site quite a bit too.
Hawaii, yeah. So we stood up a hub We're experimenting with expanding around the country, and Hawaii was a great place to start because it's literally the most isolated place in the United States. And about like 10% of the population is military, active duty or veterans. So we stood up a hub out there and started providing programs and services out there as well, to kind of as a testing ground for expansion over the next couple of years.
Beautiful. Well, I want to get to where people can find that. But before we do, I want to throw some closing questions at you. So the first one I love to ask, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our conversation today or completely unrelated.
Man's Search for Meaning and Atomic Habits.
Brilliant. I got Man's Search for Meaning sitting in front of me right now. I've heard lots of good things about Atomic Habits. All right. What about films and documentaries? Any of those that you love?
Braveheart, Last Mohegans, Gladiator, The Patriot, and Interstellar. Just my favorite movies.
So you like movies about Australians helping Scotland and America?
Yeah, Gallipoli, right? Can't forget about that one. One of Mel
That's
Gibson's
one
original ones.
Us.
Yeah. Yes. Like related to mental health or just in general?
Anything.
Yeah. I just grew up on like those war movies. Like Braveheart was like my hero. So yeah, like I don't get inspiration from movies so much as I would like, movies are tricky, right? Because they can inspire the hell out of you and give you these crazy set these crazy expectations on who you should be and who you want to be. Like, are they really there to truly inspire? Are they there just to like stimulate emotion and invoke, you know, some passion in something? So I think I would look at like the average of all the movies I've ever watched and the themes. And it's really like the hero's journey, right? Like just struggling with something, being resilient and coming out on top and, you know, setting into the sunset with the things that you value the most, which usually ends up with your family, right? At the end of the day. So.
All right. Well, the next question, is there a person that you recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military and associated professions of the world?
Yes. Aaron Leonard. He's my, he's a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, served, you know, for 35 years. He is our executive director of another summit, the Outdoor Adventure Program. A wealth of knowledge, is like the expert in outdoor adventure therapy for veterans and first responders. And has a very unique way of looking at the world and has been around the block for quite some time. So I would probably recommend him. He's a pretty interesting guy.
Beautiful. Well, if you're able to help me, I'd love to get him on.
For sure. And there's probably some more that I can drum up.
Beautiful. Well, speaking of which, Joe McCulloch, we talked about earlier, what about O2X? Just as a quick tangent. Did you work for them for a little bit?
Yeah. Yep. And I still do occasional side work with them. I mostly do leadership like work with them. So I used to run some of the workshops, and I love O2X. They're on a mission to do some real good stuff, and they're growing at a tremendous rate, have an excellent mission, and their people are top notch. So I still do some work with them on occasion.
I went to two of the 4 days with an O2X. So I think it was Fort Lauderdale they were doing it with, and Adam was actually down there. So we talked. He's been on the show as well, and twice now. But yeah, I was really impressed with what I saw. I mean, you obviously get, you know, exposed to not only the strength and conditioning side, but also nutrition and mental health and understanding sleep and all these other elements too. So I think of the things that are out there, they're definitely doing a lot of these things right.
They are a powerhouse, and they're on their way to do tremendous good. They already are, but they have a really, really incredible mission and good people.
Absolutely. All right. Well, then the last question before we make sure where everyone can find you and the nonprofit, what do you do to decompress?
What do I do to decompress? I would say I go on walks. Walking. I walk. I move and I walk. That's what I do above all else. If I'm having a hard time, I'll just go walk. And it usually solves everything. Not solves everything, but gets me into a better place to solve my problems.
Going back to when we were talking about COVID, this is the irony, is that, you know, when people needed it the most, the parks, the gyms, the beaches were all closed. You know, community was kept from people. And these are the very answers I get over and over again. Time outside, time with my family, time with my friends, you know, movement. I mean, all the things that, you know, we were told not to do in 2020. So, you know, I guess they say with a bad leader, you know, you learn what not to do. I think it's the same thing. If you look at how that was handled, do the polar opposite, we'll fix the mental and physical health crisis.
Right. Right. Yep. Well said.
All right. Well, then for people listening, where can they find Guardian Revival? And then where can they find you online?
Yeah. So I have a LinkedIn. I don't have an Instagram, but guardianrevival.org is our website, and Instagram, our handle is @Guardian Revival. So you'll be able to pull us up, or you can Google us. It's pretty easy to find us on Google now. And then keep in mind, we have our 1 mile challenge coming up, which is starting in September, which is Suicide Awareness and Prevention Month. So you'll see that placard all over our website as well. So if you want to get involved and join a really awesome 30-day challenge, you should check it out.
So what does that involve?
It's you walk 1 mile a day for 30 days, and it's $50 to sign up. You get a participant completion kit at the end of the month with a shirt, bracelet, stickers, magnets, things like that. And the idea is that you're raising awareness on mental health and suicide prevention, and you're actually getting the opportunity to do something consistently for 30 days to start your wellness journey, or to refresh it for those that have been on it for a long time.
Beautiful. Well, Alex, I want to say thank you so much. It's been such an amazing conversation. I mean, we've been all over the place, and from your father's own service and then struggles and his sobriety to, you know, not only your service and sobriety, but also the, you know, the nonprofit that bloomed out of that. So I want to thank you so, so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time, James.